This is Danny Rubin. I wrote Groundhog Day, the movie and the musical, and this is the NCVD's podcast.
That's right, my friends. You heard correctly. Our guest today is the writer of Groundhog Day. I'm your host, Nick Savides, and this is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working well with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Sometimes we talk about trying to make the world better in some way. Groundhog Day does all of that. It's creative, imaginative, and maybe makes things a little better for you and for the millions of people around the world who really appreciate it. As Danny suggested, Groundhog Day is now also a musical. It opened in London, won the prestigious Olivier Award for Best Musical in 2017, and now it's in Broadway and got several Tony nominations. The film has meant a lot to me for so many reasons, so I was so excited to get to talk to Danny about what went into writing it and the collaboration process with him and director Harold Ramis and Bill Murray. We talk about some of the mechanics of the script. How does it work? They do a lot of things that are really, really well thought out. We also talk about the differences in collaborating on a film project and collaborating on a musical. So without further ado, that interview coming up next. Stick around.
This is the NCVD's podcast. Hello, hello, hello.
Danny Rubin, welcome to the NCVD's podcast.
Happy to be here, Nick.
Throughout the years, all kinds of people have connected to Groundhog Day. Some of them have reached out to you about the film. By way of introduction, tell us a little bit about some of the kinds of people who have really responded to the film.
Everybody, pretty much, on some level or another, but the remarkable letters and notes and calls that I've gotten over the years have included, I mean, there was a monk in Germany, and there was a young couple that followed the Kabbalah and the Jewish practice of mysticism. And there have been philosophy professors who say they teach this to their students, and there are psychologists who prescribe this to their patients. So all people like that.
Yeah. You know, I don't know anybody who doesn't like the film. Maybe the giant troll living under the bridge or something, but it seems like it's a pretty widely appreciated film. Is there anyone you've encountered who was just like, this did not work for me for whatever reason?
Actually, yeah. A few people have admitted that to me, which I think was brave of them.
Yeah.
Because I'm a very scary fellow.
Right, and you've gotten, I mean, all those acclaims and Bill Murray. And so it's almost like going against an American institution at this point.
I think there are, you know, people change over time and their tastes change over time. And I'd be willing to bet that a lot of the people who didn't like the movie too much, if they saw it years later, gave it another try, they would see it through different eyes. Or not, they might just hate it, which is fine. You can't please everybody.
Well, in your book, How to Write Groundhog Day, you suggest that the film was influenced by both Anne Rice's Vampire Lestat and also It's a Wonderful Life. That's yeah. A fascinating mix to me, right? So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that and other possible influences.
Well, the Lestat connection was a very specific way of how I got into thinking about this movie. That was really just a matter of my having brought a book to a movie theater to kill the time waiting for the lights to go down. And it happened to be this vampire book. And I was thinking about it before I had even cracked it, because I had read one of the other Anne Rice vampire books. And I was sitting there thinking, oh, yeah, why did I pick up this book? And, oh, yeah, because I thought she did a great job of creating people who played by slightly different rules. They're just like us, only just a couple things are different. I thought that was kind of neat. And I was thinking about immortality. And one of the aspects of these creatures was that they live forever, more or less. And I started thinking about what that would be like to live forever and how it would work. And I started thinking about that as a movie idea, and connected it with another idea I had about a guy repeating the same day over and over again, which is just a high concept sort of comedy idea. And once I put it together with an idea of person living immortality forever, sort of by making eternal life happen all on one repeating day, then I knew I had a movie that had some, you know, it was comedy still, but it had some resonance. It was still about a long human life. So that's sort of how the vampire thing got me into it. What was the other thing? It's a Wonderful Life?
Yeah.
That one, not so much as an influence. It was more like, oh, yeah, I had to come up with what movie was playing at the local movie house. And the first thing that popped into my head was it should be a movie that someone like Phil or me has seen a million times. So it's like there was really no, oh, boy, I get to relive this movie over and over again. And the first thing that I thought of was It's a Wonderful Life, which is a wonderful movie, but it does, you know, it's the same movie every year on television. And I thought that would be funny. When we got into, once this thing got optioned by Sony and Harold Ramis, and Harold and I started working on it together, he brought up that It's a Wonderful Life was a little bit self-reflexive because our movie was a little bit like that. And it hadn't even occurred to me before, but he was right. So that's when it became Heidi 2.
Right. So... Do you think it may have been in the back of your mind, though? Because you do have that moment at the end where the community comes together and they affirm Phil, similar to the way they come together to affirm George in the way that he's been a part of their lives.
I suppose a lot of that is just in our collective unconscious, just from all the movies we've seen and small towns and people coming together. It's not unnatural that that would be the progression of a happy movie.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your writing process. You mentioned in the book that you got the first draft out in 4 days, which is just astonishing.
Well, no.
You got the 7 weeks of outlining, right? So
right.
If you could elaborate on what the outlining process is like for you.
Well, at the time, it was brainstorming every idea I could come up with. Some of those were character ideas or scene ideas or just a funny line or a plot twist or a thematic intent. And I just did that constantly. And every now and then I would take a pause and say, okay, where are we? And I would write all those things on little index cards and toss them into piles on the floor, I think, because there wasn't enough room on the corkboard, and sort of spread them out in a way so I could look at them as a whole, kind of stand back and look at them and see what fit into the progression and what went where. And then I would move to the computer and put them in a certain order and kind of talk about just to myself what I thought would go in each scene. And when I thought I had it down to really, I can't keep playing with it and fiddling with it. I really just need to write it now. I decided that I wanted to write it quickly, and I set myself, I don't know, I decided that I could write 6 pages in 2 hours. So I set up a schedule where I had 2 hours in which to write 6 pages, and if I got done early, great, and if I didn't, I had to keep going. And then I would get an hour off, and then I would do two more, and I could go make 30 pages a day that way and do that for 4 days. And it was grueling, but it was also kind of fun. And I had to make quick decisions and just keep moving. And then, you know, again, it's a cheat as a way of talking about it. I didn't mean to be self-aggrandizing. The truth is, after the 7 weeks and then after the 4 days, then maybe another week of polishing and moving things around and making things a little bit smoother and better. So it was like that.
And so on your index cards, I think you show an image where there are about 15 of them. Are you putting extensive notes on both sides, or it's just like, here are the key points?
I think I try to make it as a shorthand to myself, and I've got longer things written out elsewhere because I don't want it to get overburdened with a lot of extra notes there. But sometimes I wound up doing that. I'd wind up filling in the back and then another card with notes of things that would be part of that scene and just make sure and keep those cards together.
Do you have writing exercises that you like when you're trying to move the story forward and don't know where to take it?
No, not really. There's nothing I depend on. And one of the things I do like about screenwriting is it is kind of project oriented, and each new project requires you to kind of create an original scaffolding for it, a way of approaching that project. So I tend not to go through the same routine other than trying to open my mind to, okay, how am I going to do this one? Maybe this one, the way to unlock it is by starting to write the scene that I know best and then start to work in both directions from there. And in others, I feel like I have to outline it from the beginning to the end, like I did with Groundhog Day. There have been a couple that I've decided, you know what, I don't want to get into a situation where I'm painting myself into a corner here. That could easily happen with this project. I'm going to come up with the ending first and then work backwards from there. So everything will always lead up to where I'm going. So yeah, every project is different, and I wish I could give people, you know, writing exercises. I think the best exercise is just to start writing. Writing is the thing that teaches you what you have to do.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the structure of the film. If you had to break it down, Groundhog's Day, it's got a lot going on, but if you had to give a streamlined sense of how it moves from the different acts, how would you go about breaking it up?
Well, originally, it did not conform exactly to a Hollywood romantic comedy structure. The traditional first act is what you wind up seeing in the movie. Where I began with it, and my approach and that Hollywood approach, which is the way Harold came at it, you know, kind of worked against each other and worked with each other to make the structure that we wound up with. In my original, I wanted him to wake up already in the repetition. You would see that his life progressed in a series of stages. And from the stage of really wanting to escape to the stage of realizing that you can actually do anything and the world is your oyster within these constraints of this one day. And then finding out that that's actually not enough and kind of depressing and being completely stuck again and going from that to being suicidal. And then realizing that he can't escape from that. See, each of these takes up a section of time for him to live that and for the reinforcement of each day of activity to move him on to the next section. So not being able to escape from this life, even through death, he concludes that he's a god. And then he decides, well, what kind of god should I be? And the character of Rita is helpful in helping him figure that out and realizing that once he's outside of himself, which he is after he's killed himself, he is more open to the rest of the world, his own possibilities that he hadn't considered, like learning the piano, and opening up to other people and realizing there are a lot of worlds within this one world. And then the final step was realizing that as powerful as he is within this world, there are some things he can't control, including the death of the old man. And once he has accepted that there are things he can do and things that he can't, and he's going to make the most of the things that he can, and that he's able to see the world through other people's eyes as well as his own, then he's ready to move on in his life, and he's suddenly lovable to Rita, and that's the signal to us that things have changed. So there, I've told you the whole kind of story structurally based on the story, not based on like Hollywood beats. The way, and Harold and I talked a lot about structure. Neither of us were into the three-act structure. We sort of thought that every good screenplay really had six or eight acts. They have that, whatever they have. And that's kind of the way ours was. But he did feel a need to, in working through his own taste and working through with his staff and working through what the studio was up for, he restructured it to bring it back to a more typical first act, introducing Phil in his environment, showing a very unlovable character who is not in love with his own life, and sticking him in the worst day that he could imagine. And then the worst thing that could happen is to be stuck repeating that day. And there's the end of act one. In mine, he woke up exactly the same in bed, in the bed and breakfast, the way we see him when that happens. And the radio DJs come on and I Got You, Babe, and all that. And then he mouths the words that the DJs are speaking along with them. And we realize this is weird. How does he know what's going on? And then he knows what the chubby guy is going to say. And then he knows what Mrs. Lancaster is going to say. And then he walks outside and takes off his gloves. And so a real friendly guy comes up and says, Phil Connors. And he punches him and goes on very casually with his day. And so the whole time we're wondering, what's going on? Who is this guy? How does he know things? And then the end of the first act is when he wakes up and we find out that he's repeating the day. And what I felt I got for that was all the exposition I needed about Phil and about his being in this town and the predicament that he's stuck in without having to explain the predicament, which was sort of my clever way of getting around that by starting after it happened. And there you are.
Okay, so what about the third act? When would you say that starts?
The third act begins when he realizes he cannot save the old man.
Ah, right, because he's not God at that point.
That's right. Or from his way of thinking, it really doesn't matter if he's a God or he isn't a God. He's still stuck in this predicament. He's still got to deal with things the way everyone else here is dealing with things. So that, I think, is the final beat. And that's the way it works in the movie. At the end of that bit, he's able to... we see him give that wonderful speech at the beginning of his day that shows that he's more thoughtful than he was before. And we see how the people respond to that. And then he goes on and does all of his good deeds. And we see at this point, Rita is chasing him as opposed to the other way around and finally chases him down. And the day has changed. So, and that's pretty much the structure we stuck to in the musical. There didn't seem to be a good reason to change it, and it's what people were familiar with. It's quite solid. So we changed a lot of the scenes that we showed and the scenes that we sang and the way the music took up some of the drama and the way the town became one character, really, because of the choreography. And we were able to rearrange it a little bit, but the structure is pretty much the same.
Okay. And we'll come back to the musical here in a moment. But going back to the film, you all do a lot of setups in really clever ways where you're sometimes setting up the joke that comes just a few moments later. But in other cases, it's setting up something that will have a payoff later towards the end of the film, like Ned Ryerson or the old man who you mentioned, the beggar who dies. So I was wondering, what advice do you have to other storytellers about being able to get so much mileage out of different setups in a film?
I don't know how to answer that about setups. My mind started wandering thinking about building the characters of a film and how, and I guess it's the same of building the moments. You sort of go through in the order that you thought of it or just get it out on paper and you put it all in there. And then you really do want to see how much you can simplify, because that adds power. So, if you have 12 characters and they each have their own little thing, that might not be powerful enough because we don't focus on them enough. So maybe you take a couple of the characters and combine their traits or combine their scenes into one person. And as you go through in the rewrite process, really, maybe you can do it in your head, but as you go along, but I can't, I got to get it down on paper and then do it again. And each time kind of reevaluating what I need to emphasize and what needs to come forward or what needs to move around. So in order to have something that is built, initiated somewhere, say in the first act, and you don't pay it off till somewhere in the third act, you sometimes have to know all of your bits in order to see which ones you want to stretch out all the way around. So that's sort of an abstract way of looking at it. Did you have any specific examples you wanted to think of? Because maybe I could tell you how they happened.
No, I mean, it makes sense because you're spending a lot of time outlining. So it seems like it's a natural progression. Like you're saying, you know the beats of what you want to do and you can juggle them around.
Some of it isn't, it isn't like a joke payoff. Like in the musical, I decided to give the old beggar one line, and the line he says over and over again is change, mister, because he's begging for change. But every single time Phil sees him, he's telling him basically change.
Look at you, clever.
Yeah, it's clever, but you don't notice it until the last time he does it, which is when you want to notice it. And that's the kind of thing that makes an audience go, oh, and feel like they've been learning things along the way that have a reason, and that makes them very satisfied.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the beggar has kind of that effect in the film, right? You see him, he's sort of like this background character, and you keep running into him, and then at the end, it's like, oh, wow, it leads to that really profound moment. Or even the way that Ned is kind of a bellwether for Phil's sensibilities. He's annoyed by him, then he gets mean and he punches him, but then towards the end, he's trying to be friendly even to him. So yeah, anyway, it was neat to see the way that happened. So let's talk a little bit about your collaboration with the director Harold Ramis.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you were both pleased and wary when you first met him, because he's also an accomplished writer. He's got a comedy background, and that you all might have conflicting visions. How did you all develop your relationship so that you could work together even when the creative differences come up?
Well, we're both friendly, affable, open-minded, reasonable people. And we were going at it with that spirit in mind. And he knew that a lot of the things that he liked about the original screenplay were things that kind of went against the Hollywood norms. And he was both supportive of that. That was part of what he liked about it, and a little bit wary of it. I would say that our meetings were happy and friendly and cordial, but we were also kind of circling each other. And I was trying to figure out how I could protect my material at the same time wanting to be as helpful to him as I possibly could. And he was trying to figure out how to satisfy what he knew was working in the original material, but he also knew had to change in order to become a studio film. So it was, I guess, with a kind of mutual respect that we went forward. Ultimately, it turned into what always happens in Hollywood is it's the director's film, and he has to ultimately make the decisions and get it made. And so there was a little bit of back and forth where he took over the project, then kind of gave it back to me for a little while, and then took over it again. And that was fine. I was on it. I was sort of on the sidelines while he did a draft. Then Bill Murray was cast, and then I was back in it. And then he had to make his movie. So he really needed to do things without asking my permission, maybe sort of sheepishly calling me and saying, I had to do this. I told you I wouldn't, but I did. And I would say, Harold, you got to do what you got to do.
was that pretty heartbreaking? Was that like after, you know, crying or getting a few drinks, like, all right, fine. That's just going to completely change months of my life's worth of work here. Or it was sort of like, well, you got to roll with the punches.
It was some combination of those two, to be honest. I usually, if he said no to something, or we're going to do it this way instead, I would usually bring it up one more time and make my argument. And occasionally I was able to prevail, but usually he would say no again. And then I would say, okay, I gave it the good fight. I did what I had to do, move on. You know, I knew what I was getting into. The only thing that made it difficult was it really so felt like I had come up with something pretty unique and wonderful. It felt like a writer's piece. And I didn't want that to be squandered by making it just like an adolescent comedy. I wanted to make sure that the parts that felt like it was about a human life and that had a lot of relatable elements and themes didn't get lost in a Bill Murray Saturday afternoon.
So were you ever like, come on, we're not doing Animal House here or whatever. I don't know.
I wasn't quite rude enough to have said that. Okay. But that was...
But you may have been thinking it?
I may have been thinking it, and I also, to some extent, might not have even been ready to articulate that. I just sort of had this unease and wasn't always sure why. I know there was one point on the set where I kind of really got disoriented when they showed me a big cartoon groundhog cutout that they were going to put out on Gobbler's Knob. Uh-huh. And they, the art department was so proud of it. And I was looking at this silly cartoon and thinking, oh, they're going
to
make the cartoon.
What have you done to my beautiful movie that was nuanced about? Yeah.
Something like that. And there's no writer who does not feel that way to some extent once they have to hand their baby off to an actual production where their dreams have to be very specifically realized. You know, you could be a really crazy great architect, but if the roof just can't be built without leaking, you know, why are you going to do that? So I had to sort of lay back and say, well, now I'm a guy who got a movie made, and that's good for me. And I wish it could have been a little different, but oh, well, it's got these good people in it. And then it came out and I was sort of shrugged my shoulders, not quite sure whether he had pulled off what I'd wanted or not. But then I saw it a second time with an audience and people were seemed to be getting it. And I thought, brilliant, good. We all did our job.
Right. So let's go back to those moments. There is, let's say it does come up, there is a disagreement, creative difference, and the director or the producer is going to go in a different direction from what you all discussed. What would be the ideal way for him or her to go about expressing that with you or with another writer?
Oh, just tell me.
Just be straightforward, well, we'll see. We'll right. talk about it. We'll put it right. off.
No, being able to kind of work your way through the forest of egos and creative people. And I don't even mean that in a bad way, just people who have very strong creative point of view. In order to make something concrete that's out of it is such a difficult job. And one of the tools that they use in Hollywood is deception. Uh-huh. and not telling you news in a timely manner and sort of just waiting for something good to come along before you hear about something bad. I mean, they're constantly
till the weekend or something when everyone's out for drinks. Like, oh, by the way, that right, thing. Like, okay, see you tomorrow.
Like the news cycle.
Yeah.
So
it sounds like you'd prefer it if someone was just like, "Hey, Danny, here's the thing. We'll tell you right from as early as we can. This is where we're going. Can you come to terms with it, or what?"
Yeah. I personally operate much better that way and have found trying to figure out what people mean instead of what they say to be not one of my biggest skills.
Yeah.
And so I can do it now much better than I could when I was, you know, 30 or 33 and making Groundhog Day the movie. The collaboration on the musical was much more the other way for a variety of reasons. And so served as a great satisfaction for me after all these years.
How so? How was it different?
It was a collaboration of equals,
uh-huh.
as opposed to in Hollywood, which either for just cultural traditional reasons or because of whatever the necessities are of making a film, the writer is not really given the kind of stature they are in the theater world. In the theater world, nobody changes a line without sort of coming to you on their knees humbly. Right. And Mr. Rubin, can I say is instead of was?
Do they have to kiss the ring? Well, I will allow it, but you must kneel down.
It's a kick for me. I mean, as big a kick as people at Harvard calling me professor.
Right.
You know, it's nothing that I need, but when it shows up, it's like, wow, that was really something. So it was same with, you know, actors asking me about lines or the director. You know, nothing goes into the script until I have approved it or rewritten it. And so it isn't just that kind of creative deference, which made it really a pleasurable collaboration. There was also the fact that the composer, Tim Minchin, and the director, Matthew Warchus, and I sort of agreed from the first day that the best idea wins. And so we were constantly arguing with each other about how to proceed with this or that. And it was always the best idea won. And it was such a lovely, friendly, fun, and long-term collaboration. The collaboration with Harold was on and off over a year, mostly off. And the collaboration with these guys was on and off over 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And so we spent a lot of time together, either in a room pacing or excitedly at the computer and the keyboard or on Skype on three continents. And it was just so much fun. And the final thing was we had a variety of workshops where we're, you know, trying out versions of the script and building it with actors and musicians. And it was me at the table with Tim and Matthew running a scene and then putting our heads together, figuring out how to fix it, typing up a new version, putting it up real quickly. I usually had a projector and we put it up on the wall and the actors could just go from that version instead of copy machines and such. And that way I was in the room working with the actors, reworking material with those actors on that set, which is what Harold had as his privileged position as the director of the movie. So they built a lot of it, you know, interacting with Bill Murray and the other actors, and you get on the set and you go, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do this? And I never got to do any of that on the movie.
Oh, really? You weren't there for the rehearsals or on set when they were shooting?
There really weren't rehearsals. That's not really how you do movies. You kind of, you know, there's a table read. I was there for that. And then while they're setting up cameras, you have a chance to kind of run through the scene a couple of times. But for that camera setup, it's usually very short. So it's not that big a deal to just do that rehearsal then. So it's different. It's you're very much on your feet, kind of. Here's the cameras, here's the set. Oh, it's snowing today. Let's run over there and shoot that. And you're able to really react to the environment and to the moment and to the actors there with those props that you've got. And that's how a lot of the film gets built. And then you have the test audience and you do a reshoot based on comments. So I was not part of any of that process, really. I was just sort of the kickoff guy. And in the theater thing, I was. And so I got to have the fun of that and the satisfaction of it. So you'll see the musical is very much an echo of the movie, but everything winds up, you know, it's got certainly a lot of Harold's influence and Bill Murray's as well and the other actors. But it's rebuilt from the start through my eyes, shared with the director and the composer.
Okay. Yeah, that's neat that you got to have that experience. I want to take a quick break from our conversation with Danny Rubin to tell you a little bit more about some of the things I do when I'm not working on this show. I also help to co-organize a screenwriting group here in Baton Rouge called Screenwriters Down South. And as it happens, this June, last Tuesday of the month, we'll be doing a meeting about Groundhog's Day, going into it in even more detail than we're discussing here. If that's of interest and you're in Louisiana, look for us on Meetup or on our Facebook group. We have a lot of active writers in the area coming together, sharing camaraderie, support, feedback, and it's a chance to learn and grow in a friendly environment. I'd like to think we're friendly. So come by and say hello. I also do some writing as well, either for my own projects or working with others. As I've mentioned before, I'm not looking for lots of additional collaborations. I'm looking for the right collaborations. If you connect to some of the things I talk about on the show, there's a good chance we might be a good fit. We might be able to do something interesting together. So let's talk about it. Shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncevides.com. Once again, podcast@ncevides.com. So let's have a conversation and figure out how we can help each other. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Danny Rubin. Got to ask about Bill Murray, just as a last point on the film side.
Sure.
Were you nervous about him being involved? I mean, a big, high-powered superstar. Again, someone who's got a distinct creative sensibility. And what was that like collaborating with him during the film?
I didn't have any problem with the creative input superstar part. The part that scared me, especially before I sort of saw what he was doing, but when I first heard that he had been cast, was that he was a comedian. He was basically known as a comedian and maybe a comic actor, but more on the comedy side. He was Bill Murray. And what I wanted desperately in this piece was an actor who could do comedy. And because I felt like it was a good actor's piece and that the choice of Bill Murray was the same as seeing the cartoon Groundhog, I was afraid that that was a choice towards not taking the material seriously enough.
right? Like not giving it enough dark edges, doing the sitcom version of it, let's say.
That's right. I mean, it wasn't even the darkness. It just sort of felt like it was a drama that was going to be very amusing and a lot of fun, and in many places very funny, in some places very heartbreaking. But to have real people playing real people instead of kind of cartoon character people playing a sitcom idea, it seemed to me important in terms of selling it to people. But that, you know, that was my thinking at the time and my fears. And I had just moved to L.A. from Chicago, and I had a wife and a baby and a mortgage. And I was kind of thinking that this could be a brilliant kickoff to a brilliant career, or it could be a quickly forgotten little thing. And my future was going to be better if it was a brilliant kickoff.
Right.
I was just taking all of these little things very seriously.
But it felt like he did give a dramatic performance.
I agree. I do not fault what he did at all. That was just my fearful anticipation. In the end, he totally did a great job. He really pulled off being an actor. He took it seriously as an actor's role. And I think he's still proud of his performance.
Any fun little moments that you two had together?
Yes. But I'm going to keep those to myself.
Right.
I don't have a lot of Bill Murray stories, but I love them and they're mine.
Yeah.
So
all right. So something to say for the blokes who buy you drinks at the bar, perhaps.
That's very true. That's what it'll be. If you ever take me for a drink, I'll tell you my Bill Murray
story. All right. All right. Well, so let's talk about the musical. From what I'm hearing, it sounds like it's been such a great experience for you. But going into it, there might have been a little bit of resistance to come on board with it. I mean, you're taking something that was a big iconic hit and doing it again without some of the other key people. And surely if it didn't go well, you would possibly get blamed. And if you kept a distance, you could say like, well, hey, they didn't bring me in. That's why it didn't work. Or if it does work, it's like, hey, well, it was based on great material. So what was it that convinced you to go on board with the musical version?
Oh, I never doubted that it could be good. I never doubted it, and I never feared that I would get blamed for anything. I sort of figured if it didn't do well, or if it was wound up being a local production somewhere, that would have been fine. I just felt like it was something on my plate that I was burning to get to. And so, yeah, it didn't even occur to me that it was messing with something. I mean, increasingly, it became clear that this is a beloved property and I didn't want to mess it up. And so I was paying attention to the fact that I had a responsibility to do a very good job with it. And I wasn't going to just sell it off and let the studio make it with whoever won a Tony last year and whether they were right for it or not. And everybody winds up with plausible deniability and you spent a fortune and it's a big flop. And it
and then
wasn't,
they could be like, hey, come on, we brought you in, Danny. You should have ensured this was a success. What happened here?
So I was very careful. I took a very long time. I wasn't in a hurry. I always felt like I would get around to it eventually, and I used that time to talk to a lot of people on Broadway and see a lot of shows and start to get a feeling for how to make this happen, because this wasn't really part of my world. I had to kind of invent it for myself. So yeah, it went on like that for a long time until I met people who wanted to work with me on it, and I was... They were all great people with great ideas, but in the end, it just was a gut feeling that either the time of my life wasn't right to dig into it, or they weren't the right people to dig into it with. And when I got together with Matthew and Tim, it was really just one more phone call that I'd gotten of interested theater people over maybe 15 years. And so I was like, yeah, good. Love to talk with you, as I say with everybody. And the more we talked, the more I liked. And then I saw Matilda and fell in love with it and saw all of Dimension's videos and fell in love with him. And when we met, it was just instantly like we'd known each other for years. And we all wanted to work toward a project that was excellent. And part of that commitment, Nick, was that we agreed to do it for like on a handshake without any money and without any producers and without a plan in place, but just that we didn't want anyone to see it until we got it right, satisfied that the three of us had gotten something that we were satisfied with. And that's when we brought in the money people. So this was a perfect collaboration because it was all built on trust.
Yeah, and that way you don't have the external pressures to make it into something it doesn't want it to be, or you all don't want it to be. So it sounds like that's an ideal.
We didn't want it to be designed to be a commercial hit. We wanted it to be the best version of a Groundhog Day musical that we could come up with. And if it was a hit, great. If it wasn't, let the chips fall where they may. And that we were all committed to that, and we all had enough experience and big enough egos to believe that that thing actually would work out, that that was actually a plan. And it was, and it worked. And here we are on Broadway.
Yeah, and getting all kinds of acclaim. So I haven't had the chance to see the show yet. I'd like to soon. Hope it comes to my neck of the woods. But I did listen to the soundtrack, and it seems very similar, although from what I could tell in the songs, it seems like Rita has become a little more cynical, that she's got this ambivalence towards love. She's still open to it, but maybe a little more jaded than her character was in the movie. Is that fair to say, or am I just reading into something that's not there?
You're close. Well, first of all, it was a big intent of mine from the beginning, and also of Tim Minchin's, to go deeper into Rita's character, because in the film she's a little bit thin. And our other desire was to bring out more dimension to some of the town characters to the degree that we can. If in the first act we've kind of dismissed them as characters in Phil's nightmare, in the second part we get to know them as people and start to see them as Phil sees them, and get that dimensionality into the film.
Even with Nancy, who is just sort of like a throwaway joke character in the film, a funny moment, but in the Broadway version she's got that heartbreaking song of hers, which was pretty poignant, like, oh, right, that lady, wow.
Exactly, and that was our effort to kind of bring the audience on Phil's journey in an emotional way. It's not just watching Phil experience stuff. We experience the same thing. It's like, oh, I feel a little sheepish. I dismissed her.
We were judging her just like he was
just like
dismissing
Phil was.
Her. Okay.
So, and also with Ned Ryerson, who has this over cheerfulness that we attribute to his being a salesman and part of his sales technique. And he winds up singing that, he gets a bit of a story, and he sings that song about death and accepting death. And we realize the degree to which it has affected his life. And this is what accompanies Phil's final piece of his journey into Act Three, or into the final act of the play. So Rita is much more modern, I think, more contemporary, more sexual, a little tougher. But I don't think she's cynical. I think that she just had enough experiences where she really is her own woman, and she isn't spending her whole life feeling incomplete.
Well, I mean, there's that song One Day, right, where she's singing about how she was burned by romance in the past.
And so she's still hopeful, but at the same time, she's not going to just fall for it every time.
Yeah.
And it's a very ambivalent position, and I think it's kind of accurate. It kind of describes an awful lot of people, where they are at an awful lot of periods of time in their lives. So I love that character. And our actress, Barrett Doss, is bringing an incredible dimension to it. So plus the voice, killer voice. So all good.
Would you say Andy McDowell played it as more of an earnest, small-town girl professional, but open-hearted, or she was a little guarded as well?
No, I think what you just said, it doesn't go much deeper than that. She's just a light, happy person, which is what she needed to be, and which is what she, Andy McDowell, was very well cast for. I mean, it just came across in Harold's approach to the film was as a fairy tale. He saw it as a fairy tale, and he used the frog prince as his metaphor, and he saw Andy McDowell and the Rita Hansen character as being like a fairy tale princess. And that's how he lit her, and that's how Phil saw her eventually, and you know.
And you all kind of turn that on its head on the musical, because there's a line in one of the songs about screwing the frog and waking up in a four-poster
bed. Right? That's right. Yeah, and it isn't what it is to bring a new dimension to it. We're taking the Rita character now, and she's asking the question, what do I feel about that fairy tale? What is my relationship to that fairy tale? So it definitely pulls you out a complete different direction to comment on pretty much the movie version of Rita, which I feel like is progress and not any way a commentary on the film at all. The film did what it had to do. And I think we were able to give film lovers, lovers of this film, a chance to see something that takes you deeper into all of the themes and all of the characters, which is a great experience because it's also funnier and full of surprises, and we get to do magic tricks and things like that because you can't just cut the film to all of a sudden have Phil wake up in his bed the next day. You have to find a satisfying theatrical way to do that.
Right. And I'm sure folks can discover that by seeing the show. Hope it'll be touring the country soon.
Well, we take these things as a step at a time. But right now we're enjoying a very happy run on Broadway. And anybody who can get there, I certainly recommend it. It's a show I see over and over again. And every time I just love it.
Along those lines, have you ever had your Groundhog Day moment where you want to move on, but people keep bringing up things to you, specifically Groundhog Day? It's the film you did from your career, and you try to do other stuff, and now you're like, all right, fine, I'm back, and I'm doing the musical now.
It's sort of like that. I knew I was in for it, so, you know, and it was a good 20, 25 years ago that the film came out, so it's not like I haven't paced myself. So, yeah, I'm back in Groundhog Day again, but they're treating me well, and I'm having fun, so it's all okay.
Did you ever have the moment, the Phil Connor moment, where you're just overwhelmed by the Groundhog Day and trying to escape it? Probably not going quite as far as he did, but just trying to like, all right, just let me get away from this thing. I'm like, all right, fine. It's the one you want to talk about. Okay. I've worked with so many others. I mean, you've worked with Steven Spielberg and some others, right? Some industry greats. And then, and then kids like me, like, oh no, just tell us about Groundhog Day. Right.
I kind of get it. And when I have that little moment of defensiveness that comes across me, it's like, really, you know, this answer to that question has been published in 200 places. you couldn't have done a little bit of research, you know. I start to get to that moment, and very quickly now I switch over to, your life is absolutely blessed by this groundhog, and every fan and every curious person out there is so much more preferable to if this had never happened and you're still living out of your car.
Like some of the characters, do you have a little Punxsutawney Phil sewing or embroidery in your house anywhere?
Oh gosh! Well, people send us stuff, and it's kind of fun.
Does it go into the closet, or you display it somewhere prominently?
It's a combination. There's a lot of stuff. It's stuff in a box, but on my wall is a poster from the live read version of Groundhog Day that they had at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art a couple of years ago, which I had signed by everybody, and that's kind of cool. And I've got a photograph from the London Old Vic production with the cast.
London Theater. It doesn't get more fancy than that. So that way, when people scoff at you, like, oh, you did that little Bill Murray movie. Like, oh, but it was at the Vic, right?
At the
darling.
My dear, I have an Olivier. Yes.
There you go. That's right. Yeah.
You know, we've learned to embrace the groundhog. It started as sort of like just this little eddy, but it's unavoidable just because so many people know me for that. They will write to me on Groundhog Day and call me and give me gifts. And
yeah. Do you go into like bunker mode? Like, all right, I'm not answering. I know it's February 2nd. Phone is off. No emails.
Usually it's the opposite. Usually it's like, let me open my presents and you know, like Christmas morning.
Yeah.
Let me greet the day, because people are so excited and happy about it. It's one of those silly holidays that now only exists in people's minds because of the movie. I mean, for them, it's as much about repetition and making your life as good as you can and trying to open your eyes to make your life better. As much as it is about, you know, shadow or winter or any of the groundhog stuff. And so it's kind of well loved and well celebrated, and it's hard to be the Scrooge in that situation. So I embrace it.
So you talk about one of the takeaways from the film is that essentially Phil gets to live his worst day and his best day, and they happen to be the same. And it's a lot about his point of view. And so I was wondering if you'd care to elaborate. Is that something that you still find true with the musical?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, the final song is a piece of sublime Americana, kind of a Nashville piece, just gorgeous, called Seeing You. And it's all about this process that Phil has gone through at the very end, which allows him to see every moment of this day and every person here for the first time every single day, and to re-experience them and to freshly try and get a perspective on all that. So I think that that's one of the more important things that I carried from the original script and from the movie all the way through to the musical. When I was telling my partners, you know, what was important to me thematically, I singled out this idea of the fact that everything that we really need is right in front of us. There's an infinity of things to do and see and change and try, all within our existing day that we think is so horrible and doesn't have enough possibilities for us. And so the solutions are there, but we just have to be in the right place to be able to see them.
And that is just such an affirming outlook. So it's nice that the film is amusing, but it leaves you with something of substance. And it sounds like the musical does the same. All right, last question for you here. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you?
Me? Oh, boy. Yeah, you just have to be straight with me all the time. And if we wind up saying things that are not necessarily positive, we're making progress and communicating clearly. I really am very personally frustrated by the collaborations which feel like you need to be coddled and told what they think you want to hear. So if it were me, just tell it like it is. Come in with a big heart and a lot of good ideas.
All right. Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. People want to learn more about you and what you're up to. Where could they go?
Oh, they should probably listen to this podcast. It's about the most up to date.
Okay. That's nice of you to say.
If they went to my website, which is DannyRubin.com, I'm sure there will be something there that will lead them elsewhere. Or there have been 10 million really good interviews in the last 3 months. So you could just Google me and maybe something interesting will come up.
Thanks so much. You take care now.
Thanks a lot for the chat.
That was a pretty good interview, right? At least Danny's side. I don't know about me, but it was just so exciting to talk to him. Going back through it, editing it, was invigorating. It was one of those things that I'm like, all right, I can't believe I got to do this and I get to hear it again. Oh, this is terrific. So I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. A few things I wanted to touch on relating to the discussion and other tangential things. First of all, it's just so great to hear about how
open Danny is to the fans of the film. I mean, imagine doing something that touches people's lives so much that every year they send you things to coincide with your movie. That would be just great. People are sending him all these groundhog things. That sounds fantastic. And he's a very approachable guy, a very engaging guy. It was one of those things that I saw that he had a book. I read that he had the musical out now. And so I thought, all right, well, I'll give it a shot. I'll reach out and see what happens. Honestly, I was thinking I'll probably send him a message and I wouldn't hear back. Like, all right, well, it happens, but not the case. And actually, for someone who is as busy as Danny is, who was doing so much, I mean, he did the interview in the midst of the attention they were getting during the Tony Award season. And so that was just so encouraging. I've reached out to other people who have done work that means a lot to me, and it's usually not so encouraging. It's sometimes kind of a dissonant thing when that happens. But, you know, so it goes. People are busy. And sometimes you just have to take these long shots and see what happens. And, oh, man, I was just so grateful that Danny took the time to talk to me and share his perspectives. We talked a little bit about the setups and payoffs in the film. And I would encourage you to watch and pay attention to how they do it, because they do it so well. They're setting up multiple things. In addition to the ones that we mentioned in the interview, I want to call your attention to the Nancy setup. She's the one he approaches in the diner. He says, hey, by the way, what's your name? Where did you go to high school? Who is your teacher? And so on. And then that's setting up the joke. The next day he goes and picks her up using that information in the morning. Like, oh, by the way, you don't remember me. I remember you. I asked you to prom. Let's get together. And they end up hooking up that night. So it's setting that up, but it's also setting up what happens shortly thereafter with Rita. Because a few scenes later, we see Phil doing something similar to Rita. He starts asking about her. What are you interested in? What do you like? And so we see it and like, oh, I know what you're doing there, Phil Connors. But then we're a little conflicted, like, oh, but Rita, you're going to play her like that? And he is kind of trying to do that. He's trying to figure out all the right things to say so that he can kind of manipulate her. Similar to what he did with Nancy, but it doesn't work so well when he does it with her. She's different. Because we've seen him do it before, we know what to expect. And we bring our expectations and our feelings about him and Rita into the scene. So it's working on multiple levels. One or two other examples of that. I mean, they're doing it even with small things, right? When she is talking about things that she likes, who the perfect guy is, she mentions he's someone who plays an instrument. All right. Phil makes a note of that. It's not until much later in the film that Phil hears music on the radio. He says, well, all right, I'm going to go and learn to play music, but possibly connected to what Rita said earlier about her list of what she looks for in someone, tying it back in. And then you have him in the middle portion of the film where he's finally being honest. He's telling Rita that she looks like an angel in the snow. And then later in the film, you see him doing an ice sculpture of Rita in the snow that looks angelic. So it's these little moments, but they just carry them forward. They get a lot of mileage out of their moments. Groundhog Day is one of my favorite time travel films. It's technically a time loop, but he's traveling in time. He keeps going back to the same day again and again. And I was thinking about it, the time travel films that have most resonance with me are the ones where the person involved is traveling in time to change himself, as opposed to changing the world. And that goes all the way back to A Christmas Carol. You have something similar there. You have someone who is not quite getting life right. has a chance through a supernatural intervention to travel in time and possibly get better along the way. Now, there are some films, stories in this genre, where they seem to be about saving the world. It's really about the person, right? Like Back to the Future. Now, it seems like it's about preserving the space-time continuum and all that jazz, but what's the arc of it? I mean, Marty McFly is an impulsive guy who doesn't like being called chicken. He ends up doing something foolish, getting into an accident. And through the arc of those three films, he learns to be a little less impulsive and he might possibly change his future as a result, right? Or say Days of Future Past. It's about seemingly about saving the world, but really about going back and getting in touch with your earlier, less mature self, teaching that version of you the lessons you need to learn. You see it in Looper as well. It's just there's something compelling about that, more so than some of the stories where it is just save the world, right? Like they did the time loop thing in Doctor Strange. It was not as compelling to me. Very visually interesting, lots of spectacle, but the story doesn't resonate with me as much. And I would say that can happen when the stories aren't as character-driven. Groundhog Day, definitely character-driven about the different phases that he goes through trying to come to terms with this thing that he's facing. You got to wonder, is reality like that? I mean, sometimes we feel like we're stuck in our lives. We're going through the same routine again and again. But maybe there's a reason for it. Maybe there's something we're supposed to learn. The world might be trying to teach us something. We're just not paying attention. I mean, there are other stories that suggest as much. The Israelites were stuck wandering the wilderness for 40 years. They just couldn't get things right. Similarly, Odysseus, he has to wander 10 years before he can return home. He fought 10 years in the war. And then, well, all right, there are going to be consequences. You're going to be wandering 10 years before you can get back. So who knows? Maybe the universe is trying to teach us things, making us face things again and again, and we're just not paying attention. Why does this keep happening? Well, maybe we haven't learned what we needed to learn. Who knows? I want to go back to a point that we mentioned towards the beginning of the interview about how the film was inspired by Anne Rice's vampire story and It's a Wonderful Life. Now, Danny suggested it was just one of those things in the background. He had it on the marquee. But I do think that there is something to it, right? Think about the ending, the way everybody comes together in the community to show the character how much he has had an impact. I went back and thought about some of the films on the American Film Institute top 100 American movies to see, are we seeing that community ending? You're not seeing it in Citizen Kane or Godfather, Casablanca, not Gone with the Wind, or so many of the others. Mostly, I didn't see it. I mean, there are a couple, maybe kind of, sort of, The Wizard of Oz, but that's after the resolution has happened. You also see it in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is another Capra film. All the letters, oh, look, the support of the Boy Scouts, they are going to stick with you, Mr. Smith. But if you look at the two films, I would say there are some similarities. In both, you have someone who's stuck in a small town trying to get out, and then the community comes together and helps bring about the resolution. Like, it's not fully resolved until the community comes like, look, George Bailey, I'm here for you. I'll put my money in for you because you were there. And that helps him realize, like, no man is a failure who has friends. It makes him reevaluate his life up to that point. And similarly, Phil Connors
doesn't quite get the girl. He doesn't get Rita until after the community comes together. She sees them all mentioning all the generous things he's done for them. And then she does the auction bid. So it's a little different than Wizard of Oz, where the townspeople, the little munchkins, come and give thanks. It's after the wizard has been revealed, after the witch is defeated, and they're just basically coming together to say goodbye. So anyway, I would say that it is an influence, possibly more so than even Danny realized. Now, I will say, looking at the versions of the script, that community ending seems to be more prominent in the Harold Ramis revisions. So maybe it's something that he brought in. And he was the one who, I believe, decided to say, all right, well, you're making a reference to It's a Wonderful Life on the movie theater. That was one of the films that was going to be playing. He said, no, that's a little too much. Maybe he realized, like, yeah, we are drawing from at least in this version. So sometimes it's possible for a film to have an influence on us without us even realizing it. I mean, I've had things like that, in fact. And to be honest, Groundhog Day influenced a play that I wrote, and I didn't even realize it at the time. There was a sculpting scene in that. And going back and watching the film again, I said, oh, I wasn't saying I want it to be like Groundhog Day, but it was there in the back of my mind. So it might have been like that for Danny, or maybe not, but I think probably so for Harold Ramis when he did some revisions. Speaking of inspiration, another source of inspiration, at least for Harold Ramis, is the Frog Prince. In fact, in several versions of his revisions that he wrote, he has a scene or two where there's a reference to the Frog Prince. And it seems like the only reason that's there is to draw attention to that fairy tale. They took it out in the latest version and the film version, but it seems like it was there to just say, look, this is a metaphor that I'm using to think about this story. And it makes sense. You have Rita, who is called the princess by Phil at one point. She's this idealized character, and she makes Phil realize that he doesn't even like himself. He says that towards the middle of the movie. And she's also the character who inspires him to want to be a better guy. That is a fairy tale that has special significance to me. In fact, it's one of the reasons I came to Louisiana. It's a whole other story. There's something powerful about it. I mean, during that time, when the Brothers Grimm were telling it, there was still that caste system in Europe. So you have the idea of this princess, the highest in the social status, reaching out to this lowly, repulsive character. And through her goodness, she helps transform him into a prince. Something powerful about that. Someone can have that kind of impact on others and make them so much better. These days, it seems like that's become a little out of vogue. In fact, for some in the entertainment community, it's like they are the anti-Frog Prince. More like the Faustian schemer who makes a deal with Mephistopheles or some other dark entity.
You will be a most prolific artist. Your name will be acclaimed throughout the globe. It will just come at a small price. Those who look upon your work will get uglier, sicker, more diseased. But this is a small price to pay for glory. Would you not agree, exalted genius?
Yeah. Okay, what to call that fairy tale? I don't know. The Faustian zombie infector, or the Kardashian princess? I don't know. But anyway, I'm glad that they used that frog prince metaphor in Groundhog Day. Because you see Phil using his old tricks. He's got that TV personality. He's a weatherman. He's like, hey, I know what to say most of the time. I know how to fake my way through this. Until that one moment where he has all the information. And yet he realizes, oh, but it's not enough. And they do that slap montage. He tries again and again. He knows all the things that he should say, but it doesn't work. And then he has to say, well, all right, I've got to try to figure this out. And then he tries to save the old man. He can't. He can't save everyone. He realizes he's not a god. But maybe he can still try to be a better person and give to everyone else just because it's a decent thing to do. And he does that in part because of Rita's influence, I would say. He becomes better along the way. The community becomes better along the way. And that's really the heart of the film. That's the thing that gets me. It is amusing. I mean, Bill Murray, funny guy, lots of funny lines through it, but that's the part that gets me. And, you know, I see this film as a triumph of collaboration. Danny's initial spec script, very compelling, smart, thoughtful, but I would say the final result is a little better. Now, I'm not saying that for all of the revisions. Some of them, you go back and forth. It seems like, okay, Danny did his take. It had that existential flair and that mystery to it. What's going on? This strange setup. Some thoughtful ideas. And then they do the Hollywood version. Some of it seems maybe a little on the nose on some revisions. So it's sort of like they're going back and forth on the ideas. But by the end, I would say that the finished result has more heart. It's more accessible. It's funnier. And it's a testament to all of them, right? Because Danny could have come on board and said, well, no, I'm not going to allow you to make these changes. Get defensive. I mean, you read the book and you get some hint of the tension between how he wanted to do it and how Harold wanted to do it. But they had that respectful relationship. And even when they didn't see things eye to eye, they were still trying to make things work. So it's sort of like you get that in the different revisions. And it really is fascinating to see that. I would encourage you to check it out. Danny's book has his initial pass. I believe he includes the spec script he wrote or some variation of it. And then I was able to find the second revision that Harold Ramis did and the third revision that he did, and then compare that to the final version. You see things develop. Now, Danny's initial version, as he mentioned, you start in the middle of things, not sure what's going on. And that does create some sense of mystery. What's going on? You've got this strange concept. It gives you that kind of like memento feel. Oh man, what is this? This is intense. But in doing it the other way, in doing the setup first, it gives us a little more time to become sympathetic towards this character that's got some rough edges. Collaboration can allow for these things to happen if the framework is right. People say, okay, well, we're going to be coming at it possibly from different perspectives, but let's try to get the framework right. Let's try to get the relationship right and see what happens. I mean, it could have been this like cartoonish sitcom thing, all jokes and no heart or no dark edges, no big philosophical questions, but they found a way to bring that in and bring the heart and a little bit of the Hollywood happy ending and make it into something that is really accessible and beloved by so many people, right? So that is the power of collaboration. It makes what we're doing better, perhaps, than what we could do on our own. the whole is greater than the sum of its parts and all that. All that to say, this film is one that I really enjoy. I'm just so glad that it's out there, it exists, and it has inspired so many people. All walks of life have seen it and been inspired by it. And who wouldn't want to do something like that? Maybe we can all learn from it, see what works about the collaborations, and try to bring that into our own projects. I will say, too, I am quite intrigued about the musical and the way that Danny described it. It sounds like it pairs nicely with the film. It's not just a straight musical adaptation, but it takes a closer look at some of the characters who seem like stock characters and explores them more closely, fleshes them out, gives them depth, while still exploring some of the existential questions that the story raises. So I'm curious. I hope I'll get to see it at some point. Okay, so those are my thoughts. Now, a few loose ends to tie up here. In the beginning of the film, when Phil is stuck, he makes a call, trying to get out of the situation where he's stuck in town because of the weather. He says, hey, look, I'm a celebrity in an emergency. There's got to be something you can do. There's got to be a special hotline. I suspect that there is such a hotline out there for celebrities in a crisis. If you are a celebrity and can confirm the existence of this celebrity in a crisis hotline, I would be very curious to hear from you and to learn more about this hotline, as would all of our listeners, I'm sure. So, you know, get in touch. It's your chance to help us understand how the other half lives and possibly help your fellow celebrities in a crisis. Since I am not a celebrity, I will promise not to use this hotline for selfish reasons or whatnot, unless absolutely necessary. Maybe afterwards, we could even sing Kumbaya together. It would be my way of thanking you for bringing a little peace and understanding to the citizens of the world. Yes, obviously I'm easily amused and possibly looking for future topics on this podcast. Not all of the episodes are going to be as awesome as getting Danny Rubin on, so I got it planned ahead, all right? Okay, the film also has one of my favorite pickup lines. People mention the lines that Bill Murray says, and they're very funny, but the one I'm thinking of comes from Chris Elliott's Larry the Cameraman. Now, I should preface this by saying that I have been, on occasion, the cameraman. Maybe that's why it has a special place in my heart. Towards the end of the film, Larry the Cameraman says to our girl Nancy, you know, I think that most people just think that I hold a camera and point it at stuff. There's a heck of a lot more to it than just that. Hey, would you be at all interested in seeing the inside of a van? So yeah, that's the line. Thus far, I have not had the opportunity to use it successfully. But, you know, there's always a first. So ladies, if you're interested in seeing the inside of a van, then maybe you could Instagram me or something. No, I'm just kidding. I don't own a van. But he gives that great line, and the ladies just don't even bid for him. They don't even put in a good bid. At the end, in the final auction, ladies, you are missing out. Give these cameramen a chance. On a more serious side, you can see the film as a kind of lesson for the pickup artist, right? Because initially, Phil Connors is trying to be sort of like this pickup artist, where he learns the right things to say so that he can make a good impression, so that he can score with the babe, right? But then he kind of realizes maybe not the way to go. The girl sees through him. And then he actually tries to become a better person just because it seems like it's the better way to go. Why not try to make people's lives better? Might as well help them out. And as a result, Rita sees that and she's attracted to him for it. So listen to you fellas out there. Just maybe try to be a better person and see what that does. Lastly, there's the number 23. Now, those of you who listen know that number comes up on occasion. So I was wondering, was it going to come up here? Well, it did, kind of. so a weaker connection than some others. The Broadway preview was scheduled for January 23rd, 2017, but it got bumped back just for various scheduling issues. I asked Danny about it. He said, no, there wasn't any particular reason. It was just trying to get ready for Broadway. All right, so it was there, but not a strong connection like it's been elsewhere. But I did run into the number elsewhere from last episode to this. Since that time, I picked up We Don't Need Roads, a book about the making of Back to the Future. Because, you know, time travel and nostalgia and whatnot. And that one was published June 23rd, 2015. Turns out the version that was sent to the studio, the final production cut, was sent to the studio June 23rd, 1985. Michael J. Fox and Leah Thompson were both 23 when they played their memorable roles in that film. So it came up once again when I wasn't looking for it. Just not so much in this episode. It just follows me around, that number, sometimes. Honest to goodness, I did not go looking for it. It just came to me. It just felt like, oh, this would be an interesting thing to check out for whatever reason. And there it was again. That number. Oh, and you know, I think I spotted it in a notable location in Wonder Woman. Talking a little bit about Greek mythology earlier with Odysseus, a little Greek mythology in Wonder Woman. And I like that film quite a lot for a couple of different reasons. Lots of interesting things, and it may have included an appearance. Number 23 at a notable place. Now, I've only seen it once, so maybe I'm just imagining things. Maybe I'm just looking for it everywhere and seeing numbers that aren't there. I don't know. But maybe it's there. Well, you have to take a look and see. But it's an interesting point for it to come up, you know? But anyway, this is not about Wonder Woman. We might have that discussion some other day. This is about Groundhog Day. I will include some additional resources if you want to explore more. There's the book Danny wrote, How to Write Groundhog Day, where he breaks it down. He includes his original version, the inspiration, some other developments, and so on. And then there are the second and third revisions that I mentioned. I'll include links to those as well. John August and Craig Mazin of Script Notes did a script breakdown and discussion of Groundhog Day that is also quite helpful. I'll include that in the show notes. A former guest of mine, Steve Kaplan, one of Hollywood's go-to comedy consultants, he also did an extensive discussion on Groundhog Day. So that episode will be in the show notes as well. And one or two other resources that might be of interest. You can also look for our Screenwriters Down South page. So again, if you're in the area, you hear this in time, you can be a part of our discussion on it. And the show is still going on in Broadway. It looks like it's going to have an extended run in New York. Possibly, it'll maybe do a nationwide tour at some point. So maybe go buy lots of tickets so that I can see it when it comes here to Louisiana, if it makes it here. Or it's an excuse to come to New York. Who knows? That's our show. What are your thoughts on Groundhog Day? What has it meant to you? Do you have a favorite part, a favorite pickup line that you've used? Do you want to try my favorite line and tell me about your results? In any case, I would like to hear from you. Shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. And we'll discuss, or leave a comment on the page and everyone can discuss. Do you want to support the show? Do you find this stuff valuable? If so, would you share it with a friend? Subscribe on iTunes so that you can hear all of the episodes as they come in. Or just leave a comment. Leave some encouraging feedback. All that's appreciated and helps the show continue to grow. So thank you for that. Music for the show provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.